to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Black history is acknowledged in the month of February in the United States and is lived every day in the African continent. The history of the continuing genocide by attrition within the nation of Sudan, which is located in northeast Africa, south of Egypt, and east of the Red Sea and the nations of Eritrea and Ethiopia, is the topic of this edition of Radio Curious. The people of Sudan continue to be killed by war and famine, as has happened for generations. Twice, Radio Curious has considered this little-discussed topic with University of Arkansas Professor Emeritus Samuel Totten, author of Genocide by Attrition, Nuba Mountains, Sudan, and an oral and documentary history of the Darfur genocide. He is a scholar who has devoted his career to the study of genocide and genocide by attrition. In 2011, Samuel Totten and I first discussed the disaster in South Sudan. Again, in 2013, he described the genocide by attrition of the people of South Sudan, which has continued to become increasingly drastic in the past 2 years. Professor Totten has continued to follow this crisis between the people of the Nuba Mountains and the Sudanese government in the state of South Kordofan, Sudan. In late December 2014, he returned from what he described as a tough trip to the Nuba Mountains in order to carry up 10 tons of food to desperate civilians who daily faced bombing by the government of Sudan using Anatof bombers. He reports some very close calls, traveling with rebels to recently bombed villages. When Professor Sam Totten and I visited by phone from his home near Fayetteville, Arkansas, on February 19, 2015, he began with a brief history of this continuing crisis.
Basically, what happened is that the seeds go back to what is referred to as the Second Sudanese Civil War. That lasted between 1983 and 2005. It was a war between the North, which is often referred to as Khartoum, and Khartoum refers to as the peripheries, that is, all of those people outside of the Riverine Valley. And the people during that period in the South believed that they were disenfranchised by the government of Sudan. They weren't being treated fairly. And also, the government of Sudan was attempting to implement Sharia law across the entire country.
What does this mean to the people who live in the southern part of Sudan now?
Well, what it means is this, is that civil war came to an end in 2005, and there was something called the Comprehensive Peace Agreement. That Comprehensive Peace Agreement basically allowed the people of the South at the time to vote in a referendum in regard to whether they were going to remain part of larger Sudan or they were going to secede. And ultimately, with over 99% of the vote by the people in the South, they decided to secede. And out of that came the newest nation in the world called the Republic of South Sudan. The people in the Nuba Mountains, and this gets to the crux of the problem today, the people of the Nuba Mountains fought with the people of the South. They believed that they were going to be part and parcel of this comprehensive peace agreement and that they were going to be able to vote along with the people of the South to either remain with Sudan or secede. They were not allowed to vote. Ultimately, they were not allowed to go with the new nation of the Republic of South Sudan, which means that they remain under the dictatorship of Sudan, or the president, whose name is Omar al-Bashir. and they're furious about that.
What does that mean for the daily life of the people in the southern part of Sudan?
Well, it means a number of things. It means, number one, that they still feel the threat of being under the fist of Omar al-Bashir, meaning that al-Bashir can do virtually anything he wants in the south. That is, it means that if he wishes, and he has threatened this, to establish Sharia law, then Sharia law will become the law of the land. The people in the south, though, where I'm talking about, the state of South Kordofan and the Nuba people particularly, they're composed of not only Muslims, but moderate Muslims who look askance at fundamentalist Islamic law, Sharia law. They are also comprised of Christians who obviously don't want any part of Sharia law, and people who are animist, the indigenous religion. So that's number one threat. Number two, the people want to be represented in parliament greater than they are, and if al-Bashir says no, then there's the conflict. Also, al-Bashir initially, this is following the civil war, named a person named Ahmed Haroon as governor of South Kordofan, which again is where the Nuba Mountains is located, but Haroon is wanted on 43 charges of crimes against humanity and war crimes for alleged atrocities that he perpetrated, oversaw in Darfur. So there's a conflict politically, socially, economically, and the people of the South have decried that. And when the Nuba Mountains people decried that, al-Bashir threatened that he was going to basically treat them exactly the same way he did back in the 1990s.
Sam, in the last four visits that you have made to Sudan, the most recent one being in December of 2014, what have you seen?
I've seen village after village after village in the north that had been totally cleared out. They were ghost towns. And they were ghost towns because the government of Sudan had come in with their Antonov bombers and their MiG jets and attacked those villages, and the people fled. They either fled up into the mountains or they decided to try to reach the new country of the Republic of South Sudan, where there were refugee camps across the border, or they simply went out in the desert and formed internally displaced persons camps. I experienced Antonovs flying overhead all day long. And I saw in the distance, for days at a time, huge walls of smoke where villages had been attacked and destroyed. I also have to say that when those Antonovs fly over, you do not know if they are going to bomb the exact point where you're at, and that means either the truck that's moving along the ground or the souks, the open markets where you are speaking with people. And so what it means is every time an Antonov comes over, you jump out of the truck and you run and try to find a secure place, meaning either up against the bank of a wadi where you have some protection, or behind a rock where you have some protection. I also met plenty of people who were suffering from inadequate amounts of food. So they were suffering from everything from malnutrition all the way through on the cusp of severe malnutrition to starvation.
When you say jump out of the trucks to find protection, you've done that, right?
Yes, I did, many times.
What is it that draws you personally as a scholar who is focused for your academic career a great deal on genocide and genocide by attrition that brings you to this part of the world, to the Sudan?
Well, my concern is for the people of the Nuba Mountains, facing the prospect of genocide by attrition, which they suffered in the 1990s. In the 1990s, when the Nuba Mountains people were fighting along the south, the government of Sudan came in and both with ground troops and aerial attacks, forced the people of the Nuba Mountains off their farms into the mountains and away from their stores of food, their granaries, and as a result, the people in the Nuba Mountains began to suffer greatly from a lack of food and ended up eating anything they could locate, meaning roots, grasses, and leaves, and many starved to death. And it looks as if the situation may be heading in the same direction. That is, the people are already suffering from a lack of food. If these bombings continue unabated, the people of the Nuba Mountains could face genocide by attrition again.
Can you explain the difference of genocide by attrition as opposed to direct genocide? But before you do that, I want to say that in this edition of Radio Curious, we're visiting with Professor Emeritus from the University of Arkansas, Sam Totten, who has studied this situation in Sudan and the nation of South Sudan for many years. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Sam, the difference between genocide and genocide by attrition.
Yes, I mean, generally when people think about genocide, I mean, they think of direct attacks against people and mass killing through violence, whether it's rounding people up, for example, during the Holocaust, putting them in concentration and death camps, or sending them to the gas chambers in places such as Auschwitz. I mean, there are certainly other ways to kill people that make us think of genocide. A case in 1994 in Rwanda, between 500,000 and a million people were killed in what is commonly referred to as the machete genocide. The people were not killed in sophisticated ways, but they were, in fact, more often than not, killed with machetes. People basically, the Hutus killed the Tutsis by hitting them with machetes until they were dead. Genocide by attrition, on the other hand, involves a situation where, in the case of the Nuba people, they were forced off their farms and denied access, basically, to food. And as a result, they had to hunt for food constantly. And when they couldn't find it, they began to perish from a lack of food. But there's another component as well, and that is the government of Sudan, in the case of the Nuba people, absolutely refused in the 1990s to allow international humanitarian groups, or anyone else for that matter, to come in to South Kordofan and the Nuba Mountains with humanitarian aid. The Sudanese government blocked the aid from coming in. Today, it looks like the situation in the Nuba Mountains is moving towards another genocide by attrition, and interestingly and disturbingly, the government of Sudan again has blocked all international humanitarian aid from aid groups from entering the state of South Kordofan and the Nuba Mountains.
Tell us how you have been able to successfully bring humanitarian aid, food, into this area.
Well, initially, I organized a group of about five or six individuals who had experience from the United States, who had experience in Sudan in various capacities, who were concerned about the people in the Nuba Mountains, and we basically raised funds and with the goal of purchasing food and carrying it in, and we did that for roughly 2 years. And we brought in tens of tons of food in various ways during that period of time.
What are those ways in which you were able to bring it in?
We basically hired a lorry, a large truck in Kampala, loaded that up with about roughly $50,000 worth of food, and had the lorry ship it down to uh, or up over to Juba, the capital of South Sudan, and then up to the Yida refugee camp, and then over the border into South Kordofan. I oversaw that. At the same time, I was purchasing food and hauling it up in a land cruiser at the same time and taking it to different points in the Nuba Mountains. The group is disbanded. Well, the group is still working, but it's expanded its focus so that it's not solely carrying food. And I left the group with the intent to continue to solely focus on food, and that was the result of my trip in December. And what I did is I carried up approximately 7 tons of food up into the Nuba Mountains, again, various points where people are known not to have ready access to food.
How about medical help?
Well, medical help is needed. In fact, I was recently contacted by a bishop, a Lutheran bishop, a Sudanese man, who I gave a lift to when I was out in the Nuba Mountains in December. He just contacted me and actually said that groups of Sudanese people in Egypt have raised monies to purchase medicine, all types of different medicine, to bring in to the Nuba Mountains, but they don't have the funds now to pay for the transportation. I haven't been bringing medicine in. We have brought in what is referred to as plumpy nut, and plumpy nut is a very highly concentrated type of food that is high in nutrients that international humanitarian aid groups bring in when people are known to be starving, and we have brought in plumpy nut.
With very few exceptions, the information that you're sharing with us now on Radio Curious is not revealed in the news of the United States. Why is that?
Yes, yeah, disturbing, and I think that there are a number of different reasons. One, I think, and this happens all the time, is that new events overtake previous events. I think today the focus primarily is on ISIS, and rightly so, and the radical Islamists who were active not only in Iraq and Syria, but Libya and other places, and you know the recent attacks in Paris, and now more recently in Denmark. So Sudan almost altogether, not only the Nuba Mountains, has kind of fallen off the radar, so to speak. But I think there's something else at work there. There's, of course, the ongoing conflict in Darfur, which the international community focused on to a large extent in the early part of this century, activists as well. And while there was a lot of attention on Darfur in the early part of the century, there's virtually none now. And Darfur has basically unraveled, and there's incredible violence in that part of Sudan. And it's crumbling, and not only is it crumbling again, but international humanitarian groups are pulling out because the violence is so bad. I think that part and parcel of this at this point in time is that, ironically, Sudan remains a stable nation, even though it's authoritarian under a dictatorship. It remains stable. It hasn't fallen apart like Libya did. It hasn't had the convulsive violence like we saw, at least in Khartoum, like Egypt did. It's not absolute chaos like we see in Iraq. And over and above that, rumor is out that the United States government has been allowed to place drone bases, very tiny drone bases, all around Sudan to be used as detectors for radicals crossing the Sudan.
When you say radicals, radicals from where, about what?
Yeah, well, this goes back a good number of years before ISIS, but the United States was concerned about radical Islamist members of al-Qaeda and other groups heading towards Afghanistan and Iraq to fight in the war. And so early on, many years ago, the U.S. government was tracking these individuals, also operating in Sudan to make sure that cells of terrorists were not allowed to be based there as a point of departure for either Afghanistan or Iraq, and those efforts continue. The way I've described it is it's kind of a quid pro quo. That is, while the government of the United States will put pressure on al-Bashir periodically, it's not going to hit al-Bashir with the sanctions that it hit Iran with. That's number one. Number two is, because of that, then the government of Sudan will allow these small drone bases to be placed around Sudan. So there's this quid pro quo. I think if anybody looks at the situation in Sudan, you'll see that, yeah, the United States government is active there in talks, but that's all it is. Largely talk, and more talk.
Why? Why is that the posture of our government now?
Well, I just explained that it's a quid pro quo situation, number one.
What the United States gets out of it is the opportunity to observe who's coming and going into that country.
Yeah, that's right, in regard to terrorist activity. Now, there are others who have claimed the United States has its eye on Sudan's oil. That may be the case, but at this point in time, my sense is that this watching for terrorist activity has been the primary concern of the United States.
Sam Totten, what has drawn you personally to study and teach these issues in Northeast Africa?
Well, it goes back a long, long ways. For many years, I was involved in the work of Amnesty International. I mean, that goes back to 1976 when I lived in Australia. So it's a concern for individuals who are being ill-treated by their government. Genocide, of course, is not focused on individuals, but on groups. And I eventually moved from focusing on individuals with Amnesty International to focusing on groups because very few individuals back in the 80s were focused on the issue of genocide. And so I moved in the direction of changing the focus of my research into genocide. But an opportunity in 2004 to go with the United States government to along the Chad border to interview refugees from Darfur, which was deemed at that time a potential genocide, if not actual genocide, really is what drew me to Sudan, because I spent about 8 or 9 years going back and forth along the border, Chad-Darfur border, to interview refugees about their experiences in Darfur. Ultimately, I had an opportunity to go into Sudan itself in the Nuba Mountains, and it just so happened that this war broke out while I was conducting research into both Darfur, as well as the genocide by attrition in the 1990s. So it's been a natural progression.
Well, Sam Totten, I'd like to ask a couple more questions about you. One of them is, and you may have just addressed it, an aha or eureka moment throughout the history of your life that addressed your life, that redirected you, or gave you a philosophy by which you live now.
Been a number of them, but the major one was right after I graduated as an English major from college, and I had moved to San Francisco to pursue writing a novel, which I think a lot of English majors dream about. And I was living in an old Chinese hotel in Chinatown, and for $15 a week, I didn't have much money, and so at night I would spend my time in City Lights Bookshop, which at that time was not the huge, huge draw it is today for tourists. And every day I would, every evening I would go down and I would sit in the basement and read different books and different magazines. And I came across this article by Rose Styron about torture in Chile. And it just astonished me. And I didn't know how pervasive torture was. That's what moved me to join Amnesty International and become very concerned about the deprivation of human rights.
And Sam Totten, what would you like to do with the remainder of your one precious life?
I think about that all the time because I'm not getting any younger. I'm now approaching my 66th birthday. So who knows how many years I have left, but I've decided basically two things. Three. One is to continue heading to the Nuba Mountains to help the Nuba people as long as I possibly can, as long as my health holds up. I'm also making a move from focusing solely on genocide to writing fiction. And the last is to spend more time with my sweet wife, who has supported me in an incredible ways to go into these areas that are particularly dangerous, and to spend more time with her and travel with her to places that she wishes to go, such as Provence, Paris, etc.
And finally, for our listeners who would like to learn more about this issue in Sudan, where can they look?
Well, I think one remarkable place to look is online, to look up a group called Nuba Reports. It's put out by what they refer to themselves as citizen journalists. This is an organization that was organized by a remarkable American named Ryan Boyette, who's lived in the Nuba Mountains for the past 14 years. He's married a Sudanese woman, and he's hired all Sudanese men, young men, to go out and report on the bombings that take place. And they do remarkable work, and their work is being picked up by media all over the world.
Sam Totten, is there a book that you could recommend to our listeners?
Well, I tell you, a book that has touched me, and interestingly, touched is a part of the title of this book, is called Touched with Fire. The subtitle is Manic Depressive Illness and the Artistic Temperament. It's by a woman named, or a professor at Johns Hopkins named Kay Redfield Jamison, and it's absolutely a fascinating book. It talks about different individuals through the centuries who have experienced not simply depression, but manic depression, and it talks about when they're on their high, not the low, obviously, how it contributes in different ways to their artistic temperament and efforts to produce art, whether it's literature or painting or something else altogether.
Well, Sam Totten, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious. Well,
thank you very much. I greatly appreciate it.
This has been our third visit with University of Arkansas Professor Emeritus Samuel Totten, a scholar who has devoted his career to the study of genocide and genocide by attrition. You may hear our 2011 and 2013 interviews with Professor Totten at radiocurious.org. The book Professor Totten recommended in this interview is Touched with Fire, Manic Depressive Illness and the Artistic Temperament, by Kay Redfield Jamison. This program was recorded on February 19th, 2015. There are over 500 editions of Radio Curious on our website, radiocurious.org. They're free to listen, download, and share as you wish. The email address is curious@radiocurious.org, and the phone is 707-462-6541. Christina Onnestad is the assistant producer, and I'm host and producer Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.